You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out a Wisconsin high school program connecting students with careers as auto and diesel mechanics. First, the State Assembly's Committee on Health met yesterday, and the topic on the agenda was abortion. There were five separate abortion-related bills getting their first round of debates. The bills include a ban on abortions being done because of the race, gender, or disability. Another would sentence doctors to a lifetime in prison if they failed to provide medical care for a baby born after an abortion attempt. Shemaine Mills covers health for WPR News. Shemaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, you write in your piece on this, this comes amidst a lot of laws in other states being brought into legislatures. This is part of a trend that Wisconsin is now taking part in.
That's right. These bills aren't proposed in a vacuum. You have a number of laws, like the one proposed here by Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point. That's been proposed in other states, and there are legal challenges. And then the most recent is Georgia's governor recently signed the so-called heartbeat bill, which would outlaw abortion at 6 weeks at a time when many women don't even know they're pregnant.
Let's look at some of the specific legislation. Let's start with the one that was authored by Senator Teston. It's a bill dealing with abortions that its author calls discriminatory, decided on the basis of a baby's race, for example, a disability status, a gender, I believe. Here's Republican Representative Barbara Dietrich talking about why she supports this legislation.
Additionally, I want to say that a child should not be eliminated due to race, color, origin, ability, gender, because it's really equivalent to discrimination in the womb.
So talk a little more, Shemaine, about what this bill would do.
Well, there would be civil penalties for those doctors who perform an abortion and can show it was for reasons based on traits like sex, gender, what the author of the bill mentioned, or a congenital deformity. And these penalties would not be criminal. People like the patient or her parents could sue the doctor. So it's not aimed at women, the authors say, but doctors.
All right, that's one of the five pieces of legislation. I want to go through some of the others. Can you tell us about legislation that would require doctors to provide care for babies that survive an abortion attempt?
Well, this basically, according to its critics, is redundant for laws we already have. In other words, doctors have an obligation to provide care, but this specifies that they would have to give the same care to an infant born after an abortion as they would any other infant. And that's why supporters say it's needed to clarify current law.
And what kind of penalties are involved in this law?
They're actually pretty strict. A doctor could face life in prison if found guilty of not providing adequate care to a fetus that survives an abortion.
That's the second one. A third bill deals with chemical abortions. What would change there?
Well, a doctor would have to tell a woman that she could reverse the abortion midway through. So you take a chemical. It's a two-step process. You take one medication. And it's at that point, supporters say, women should be told that if you change your mind, you want to reverse this, do not take the second medication. However, even supporters like Heather Weininger from Wisconsin Right to Life said it doesn't always work. So how reversible it is a matter of question.
And then the other bills involve certification for doctors who are part of the medical assistance program, doctors, if they also, as part of their practice, provide abortions.
Yeah. This bill is aimed at Planned Parenthood, but it also could affect hospitals that perform abortions. And that's why there's two bills, and the authors say they'll need to iron out the differences because, of course, hospitals don't want to lose any Medicaid money. But even if this were to pass, it still requires a federal waiver because it involves federal money. The Medicaid program is both state money and federal money. So it's not a sure thing. But it's Republicans trying to take money away from organizations that provide abortion, like Planned Parenthood.
Talking to Shemaine Mills, reporter for WPR News, about legislation reviewed by an assembly committee yesterday, five different bills related to abortion issues. Democrats raised concerns about a lot of these. I want to give a listen to Democratic Representative Deborah Colstie.
I am concerned that there's a motive other than just hearing these bills. But anyway, these bills have been heard and didn't pass. So why today five bills?
So what other kinds of concerns do we hear from Democrats and other critics of these bills?
Well, in particular, the bill we just discussed, if you take away Medicaid funding from Planned Parenthood, someone or some organization has to pick up the slack for cancer screenings, sexually transmitted disease testing, contraceptions. So Republicans say, well, we have plenty of health clinics. We have federally qualified health centers or community clinics. They can pick up these extra patients. And Democrats contend, no, there's just too many people who rely on Planned Parenthood. They just can't be shifted to these other clinics, especially in rural areas.
Now, what's Governor Evers said about these bills so far?
Well, he hasn't talked a lot about all of the bills, but he has spoken out about the most prominent one, as has our president, Donald Trump, and that was the so-called Born Alive bill. And Trump characterized it as executions, which was roundly criticized as false. And Governor Evers weighed in, calling this blasphemy, and he said he will veto it. So you can expect, if it reaches his desk, it would not be signed.
Now, this is a first step, an Assembly Health Committee looking at these five pieces of legislation. What do we know about next steps on these?
Well, apparently they're going to vote tomorrow, the committee. And once the committee signs off on it, it could go to the floor as early as next week. Maybe not all of them, but the most prominent ones. So, and that being the so-called Born Alive bill. So it's on the fast track.
That's the Assembly side of things. Before it went to Governor Evers for a possible veto, the Senate would have to get into it. Have they put any of these on the table yet?
The Senate leaders have indicated they support these bills, but they haven't set out a time frame or said when they would take it up.
All right, Shemaine, thanks for sharing the latest with us.
Thank you.
That's Shemaine Mills, health reporter for WPR News, with us today to talk about a series of abortion-related bills that got their first hearing in the state assembly yesterday. Coming up, a program at a Western Wisconsin high school is giving students a chance for hands-on experience in automotive and diesel mechanic work. We'll talk to the program's coordinator and one of the students in the program. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a student and teacher from West Salem High School about a class that lets students try out jobs as automotive and diesel mechanics. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tour of the Wisconsin night sky.
Spring heralds earlier dawns and later sunsets. The change of season also brings a whole new set of constellations into view, including some of the oldest constellations we know. UW Space Place director Jim Lattice takes us on a tour of the spring night sky.
Of the constellations that you'll see when you look high overhead there, you find the Big Dipper off to the north. Over to the west, Gemini, the twins. Then high, but a little bit to the south, is Leo. And then also high, but over towards the east, you find Virgo. And in that group, you have four of the most ancient constellations that there are, especially Leo. There are references to the lion that are like 5,000 years old, Sumerian texts that mention the lion. So that constellation was identified, already had the identity that we still give it that long ago. Virgo is nearly as ancient. Virgo had the same identity throughout history, although she's been identified always a woman, always some kind of symbol of femininity, usually purity and virginity, but she's been identified then with Ceres, the grain goddess, or with Ceres' daughter, Persephone. She's been identified with Isis and Ishtar. Anyway, but in all these cases, that constellation has this strong feminine identity, just as the lion has this leonine identity. And then the Big Dipper, which we usually say, well, that's only part of the constellation called the Great Bear, But those seven stars have been associated with a bear constellation for a very long time, all through Western, through European culture, and they have some kind of associations with the north, perhaps, with the bear as a northern temperate creature, perhaps. But those seven fairly bright stars close together there have this association with bears that goes way back in Mediterranean cultures. Although in northern Europe, the Germanic cultures called it and still call it the wagon. The Mediterranean cultures see the seven stars as a northern bear. And in fact, even the word in Italian and Latin, septentrione, meaning the seven, that's the word for north. So when you describe the word north, you're actually indirectly referring to the seven stars of what we call the Big Dipper, the seven stars of the bear. So these things go way back, and these cultural associations are relatively constant all the way back. They tend not to modify these astronomical things. Despite attempts to do that along the way, you can historically find cases where somebody says, oh, well, we really ought to redesign all these constellations. But that somehow never pans out. These things have some kind of cultural inertia that hangs in there. So it's a great time to go out and just kind of think about how long our ancestors have been thinking in the same way about these stars that we do.
Jim Lattis is an astronomer and the director of University of Wisconsin's Space Place. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. That way, you can hear stories about the amazing people, places, history, and culture of Wisconsin anytime you listen to podcasts. On the bus, in the grocery store, cruising down the street, anywhere. Just search for Wisconsin Life in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, figuring out what you want to do when you grow up has always been tough, but for a group of students in western Wisconsin, they're getting a chance to try out one path while they're still in high school. The West Salem High School's Career Academy is home to a popular program that gives kids a hands-on experience working as automotive and diesel technicians. Paul Lethen is the Automotive and Diesel Career Academy lead instructor. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you, sir.
And Adriana Eddy is a junior at West Salem High, who's part of the Automotive and Diesel program. Adriana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, start us off. Tell us, basically, how does this work for students?
Students that have a keen interest in automotive or diesel technician program, they have an opportunity to take daytime classes with me as a instructor, and those classes primarily focus on consumer or automotive consumer, a person that drives a car around, and how to take care of it and how to look out for different things. And we do have an advanced auto class that students can also take. However, what ends up happening is to continue and to further their education, we needed to come up with another class, and we decided that because there was not quite enough students to run the class during the daytime, we wanted to attract students from other schools, and so we're running this program in the evening. Students from five or six local school districts are also attend our night class, and they meld and work very closely with each other, along with we hire some instructors from our local automotive and diesel dealerships, and they come in and they help us out. Our focus is based on the Blueprint for Prosperity grant from Governor Walker a few years back. We've been doing this for 4 years now. The first 2 years we received $20,000 grants to help us pay the instructors and to help us get some specific equipment. And our focus is that in the end, these kids will have a industry certification in the student ASC area in the automotive side. If a student chooses to do that, they attend one night a week on the automotive. And then another group of students will come in on Thursday nights, and they also focus on the diesel side. So it's actually two separate programs. On Tuesday nights, we run our auto students, and on Thursday nights, we run our diesel students.
And Adriana, what do you like about getting to work with cars and other mechanical stuff in the class?
Well, no one really expects a girl to be in this industry, so being able to represent that, even in the smaller school, is really great. They get to see what you can do as a girl and how you can still work with guys and do, if not better, than they are doing as well. You also get to learn different sides to working with your hands to be able to, if one day you needed to, be able to fix your car by yourself and not rely on someone else to do it.
Can you talk about some of the projects you're working on or have worked on lately in the class, Adriana?
Yeah, so before we got into our new shop, we started out at our bus garage. We really identified the issues on diesel trucks, so hydraulic brakes on school buses, and we just looked around at all the different kinds of situations you would go through when you're examining a project, or how long you think it's going to take, what devices you should be using, what skills you should be using for which projects. Also, we toured a lot of actual yards and, like, places that you would take your truck to in this area, so that was really helpful to see what it would be like if we actually went out in the real world and was working on this. We also worked on a Freightliner truck, and we redid the brakes on them. That was really cool. Got to see how the hydraulics works in that specific truck, and we got to learn book-wise about how we can deal with that in different kinds of situations.
And Paul, as I understand it, for students who take to this and they want to keep going with this, as you mentioned, you're working with local businesses. Is this a pathway for them to get into this line of work and find a job?
Absolutely. In fact, our instructors sometimes they have a heads up with compared to a lot of the other businesses in the area. We have a tendency to see relationships develop with the instructors and the field trips and then all these businesses everywhere are looking for technicians, whether automotive, diesel, or small engine, motorcycle, and we see these people pulling these young students from the class and giving them opportunities to work as an apprentice, and then ultimately they've received many offers to pay for colleges and to get them going and starting out and in their businesses.
Adriana, I don't want to lock you into a career path yet. You're a junior in high school. That said, do you see this as a possibility going into something related to mechanics?
Definitely. I'm definitely looking at the diesel technical part at TC. Even if I don't end up doing that, that's always a back which I want to be able to go on. So I really look forward to either doing that, pursuing that in the future, or either getting more information so I can not have to always go to a mechanical shop if I have to.
And Paul, you say it's okay if not every student in the program ends up going into this line of work, right?
Absolutely, and we have a lot of students that in our auto program through the last 4 years that just everyone drives a car, and to be able to be more than just an informed consumer, someone that can fix things on their own has proved to be a huge thing for a lot of the kids in our program. But we do have a lot of students that get their entire college education paid for by local businesses because the students has demonstrated through possibly an apprenticeship program that they can do what they need to do in the shop. The service managers recognize that, and they'll put the money where it matters and provide the kid a contract. They got to sign it, and then the student gets their education paid for, and they end up in a situation where they are obligated to work for a period of time. But it's really a great opportunity for these kids.
Adriana, are you selling this program now to maybe the freshmen and sophomores at your high school?
Oh, yeah, definitely. If they're about to be in a car and need some help figuring out what to do with it, if they have no idea, that's a really good way to start. We have auto fundamentals here. I did that this year, and we always start off with WAE, and we get to learn about wind dynamics and all that other stuff, but then you eventually get into the automotive, and if you keep pushing yourself, you're eventually going to get into the night class. It takes a lot to be in the night class. If you're not willing to put in the effort, you're definitely not going to make it. But if you are even willing to show up one night a week, then you're definitely going to be able to push through. And Mr. Leith and all the instructors are very helpful. If you have any questions, you're not afraid to ask dumb questions sometimes, because they'll just give you it straight if you have any questions. And it's just really easy to talk to them and get information about why they should do it as incoming freshmen.
And Paul, my mind went straight to cars and trucks, but there's some work on tractors, at least some of the students have ended up doing.
Yeah, we've had local ag shops that take care of combines and tractors and things. We've had our students, even though they're in the night diesel class, which primarily focuses on, you know, semi-trucks and heavy trucks, they know the principles of diesel engines and just mechanics in general. And we've had students at our local John Deere dealership get scholarships to go on to school to work in ag-type equipment, big combines and tractors and things.
And Adriana, as we start to wrap up, for students around the state who maybe don't have a program like this, what would you say to them if they haven't thought about, you know, checking out mechanics, automotive, that kind of thing, maybe to invite them to at least explore it?
Well, you're never going to know unless you try. So, I mean, if you are looking at it and you're like, well, I don't think I'd be good at it. I didn't think I'd be good at it. And I'm really loving it and enjoying it, even as a female in this work field, and enjoying getting to mess around with all the different tools that you would normally not get your hands on.
And just 30 seconds or so, Paul, it sounds like the class is pretty popular.
Absolutely. And I would just say that every dealership, whether it be automotive, truck, tractor, trailer, ag, is looking for mechanics. And you know the supply and demand. Wages are going up. Working conditions are getting better. Great opportunities for students in these areas.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having us.
And Adriana, thanks for taking the time.
Of course, no problem.
I've been talking to Paul Leithan, Automotive and Diesel Career Academy Lead Instructor, and Adriana Eddy, Jr. at West Salem High School, part of the Automotive and Diesel program. They joined us today to talk about the school's program that gives students a chance to roll up their sleeves and see if the automotive field is right for them. Coming up, Americans have long been obsessed with celebrities, but big changes in technology have brought us more exposure to famous people than ever before, even if we don't want it. We look at the rise of celebrity culture from reality TV to YouTube and what it says about us and our society. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, what does the economic future hold for rural communities? Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at concerns over things like declining populations and job loss, and whether communities can turn things around. That's tomorrow morning at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, Americans have long been obsessed with celebrities. As long as there's been an audience, there have been individuals clamoring for our attention, and we tend to eat it up. But in recent decades, rapid advancements in technology have brought us more celebrity exposure than ever before, and now we're constantly surrounded by it. While celebrity culture is often described as vapid or trivial, our next guest says it has an underestimated impact on American culture. In a new book, she looks at the rise of celebrity culture from 19th century theater stars to YouTubers and what it says about us. Susan Douglas is a professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan and co-author of the new book, Celebrity, A History of Fame. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with a basic question, what it means to be a celebrity. It's more than just being famous, it sounds like.
Yeah, being a celebrity means you are visible. You have a very privileged presence on the national stage. You get to say things that other people don't get to say that have impact. So if George Clooney says something about a political issue or a humanitarian issue, he gets heard in a way that maybe you or I won't. So celebrity brings with it an enormous amount of privilege, visibility, and of course, fame and money.
But there's no such thing as a celebrity without fans of a celebrity. Talk about the fan side of the equation.
Well, really, you know, to think about celebrity culture, it really consists of four basic building blocks. There's the celebrity, of course, who has to develop some kind of symbolic relationship, you know, with fans. The fans, of course, matter. The media, the way in which the celebrity gains that visibility. And, of course, there is a vast now celebrity production industry consisting of agents, managers, publicists, you know, TV shows, the news, social media, etc. And all of those interact to produce this kind of metastasizing of celebrity culture.
Well, I want to talk about how far we go. People, I think celebrity is getting out of hands these days. This incredible story of a riot between fans of two different actors, fatalities involved. It's nuts. And it was in 1849. Tell us about this crazy story.
Yeah, so these are the Astor Place riots, and this was the deadliest event of its kind in New York up to that point. And basically, this was a riot between fans of two different theatrical stars. One was a British actor, and the other was a U.S. actor. And they were both Shakespearean stars. And one of the things that people don't know is that Shakespeare was like one of the most popular playwrights in the 19th century here in America. People watched Shakespeare not only in theaters, but in bars and beer halls. And we now think of Shakespeare as, you know, high culture, but it wasn't back then. And fans had incredibly devoted connections to who portrayed different, you know, Shakespearean characters. And so the riot happened because there were, you know, a bunch of working class guys in New York who felt that the British actor, Charles McCready, was snobby and looked down on the American actor. And so they basically went to his performance at the Astor Place Theater and threw eggs and rotten vegetables at him and stink bombs. And the cops tried to break it up. The guy, Charles McCready, said he was going to go back to England. He was persuaded to stay. The Bowery Boys came back the next night and did the same thing, and this erupted into a massive riot based on really who the fans were identifying with. And it wasn't just something superficial, because the Bowery Boys, who were revolting, they were protesting about their own class identity. They were protesting about national resentments against British snobbery. They were demonstrating about their own identity as men. And they were demonstrating for national pride. So, you know, when you have these big battles around celebrity, they might seem silly and, you know, superficial, but they're always about bigger things.
And that's a big message of your book, whether we're talking 1849 or 2019, our thoughts about celebrities, our attachment to them says something about us, our culture, who we are.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, you know, as you noted in the intro, celebrity culture has, it's just continued to metastasize. And every new communications technology has brought a different kind of fame and a different way to gain fame. You know, when radio emerged, this was a medium that denied sight to its audience. So you had to be able to tell good jokes. You had to have an appealing voice. And those were the kinds of things that made you a star in the 30s and 40s, very different from film and then very different from television. And of course, now with Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook and Twitter, there's a whole new series of mechanisms for absolute everyday people to go after that quest for visibility and fame and get it.
Talking to Susan Douglas, co-author of the new book, Celebrity, A History of Fame, Scandals, Heroes, Fandom, A Century of Stardom. Is that, now, the internet age, there's this thought that, okay, maybe if we have the right set of YouTube videos or Instagram pictures or whatever, we might be famous too. Do you think there's always been an element of that, hey, with just one break, maybe I could be that celebrity?
That's always been the mythology about stardom, and it especially gained traction with the rise of movies, because there were talent scouts who went around, this is in the teens and 20s, trying to find people who would look good first in the silent era, and then, of course, later on, look and sound good in films. And there were stories about lucky breaks, you know, people plucked out of nowhere. to become famous, and they had their biographies reinvented. There's always been that fantasy. And I think, Rod, it really rises in part from the rise of a bureaucratic society where, and our society is now more bureaucratized than ever, but, you know, that really began at the turn of the century. Everybody's, you know, has their specified job. You can't violate the rules. You can't rise above the herd. And celebrity offers a fantasy of escaping that dehumanization, of being seen as a special individual. So, yeah, people started fantasizing about that in the teens and 20s. And it's only gotten more democratized now that there are more cable channels than ever, more social media platforms than ever.
Does this fill the role of the fairy tale, the positive fairy tale? Hey, maybe I can go from my life of scrubbing the fireplace to becoming a princess?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, what's not to love about that fantasy, in addition to being seen as a distinct individual and rising above the herd? You know, if you become famous, you have other famous friends. You get to move in circles the rest of us don't. You seem on the outside to have a very charmed and privileged life. You jump to the head of the line no matter where you are. And there's an enormous amount of appeal in that, in being seen as somebody who's distinctive and matters.
I want to key in on one big cultural change, media change. Even before the internet, you write about the rise of, I think you used the word metastasize earlier, the celebrity magazine. Talk about how those changed the game.
So, you know, after a while, and this really started with vaudeville, but it really exploded with movie stars in the teens and 20s, people wanted to know what the person was really like when they were not on stage or not on screen. And you began to get, with the explosion of newspapers in the late 19th century, journalists who tried to, you know, do the behind-the-scenes stories about at home with such and such star. Now, why do those stories matter? Well, they appeal to people because they want to know, does the star really deserve my love, my fandom? What are they like in real life? What are they like in their backstage as opposed to their front stage? And you began to get more and more of these kinds of stories in movie magazines that were very carefully managed by the studios in the teens, 20s, and 30s until the studio system collapsed in 1950. And they really promoted the stars as just like us. You could be at home with the star. You learned about what they like to cook for dinner. And all of this was really designed to further cultivate the identification with the star. The more that fans identify with the star and admire the star, it elevates the star's, not just their kind of symbolic capital, it elevates their economic capital as well. So those profiles really mattered in continuing for stars to be stars.
And for that celebrity and their team, this ends up being an act of character creation, it seems like, as elaborate as anything, you know, in a movie, a fictional character. They're creating that themselves.
Absolutely. Names were, you know, totally reinvented. Biographies were faked so that the stars seemed much more alluring and exotic than they actually were. And, you know, this was really an effort to separate whatever the star's backstage was, however boring or scandalous, from the front stage that was meant to be, you know, very glamorous and alluring and enviable.
That's quite a change. You write, and I didn't know this at all. Early on, the movie studios didn't even want to they didn't want people to know the actors or actresses' names. So Mary Pickford was what? People called her the girl with the curls?
Yeah, you know, in the early days of silent films, this is, you know, sort of starting in roughly, you know, 1906, you know, the Nickelodeon period, up until the late teens, those who were producing movies feared that if the stars' names were posted on the movie, that the stars would demand more money, which wasn't false.
Fair. Yeah.
But what they failed to recognize is that by letting viewers know who the stars were, they could then build up the movie's of those stars and generate box office sales, and that's exactly what happened. They gradually, you know, put the names of the stars, and then pretty soon they put the pictures of the star and the character they were playing, so you know exactly which star was playing which character. And, of course, this boosted fandom.
We are talking right now with Susan Douglas from the University of Michigan. She's co-author of the book Celebrity, A History of Fame. We're looking at the significance and history of celebrity culture and what it says about us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a close follower of a certain celebrity or celebrities? Pictures on your wall as a teen or now? What do you, what did you get out of it? Or maybe you don't like celebrity culture, but there is someone you follow that you'd admit. You get excited if you see maybe an interview with them. Why is that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about celebrities and celebrity culture and its history with Susan Douglas. She's a professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan, co-author of the book Celebrity, A History of Fame. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think explains the appeal of celebrity? Have you wanted to be famous, a celebrity yourself? Are you content to just follow what others are doing? Do you think there's something that celebrity culture can tell us about ourselves and our culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Now, interesting, Susan, we don't have people calling in to say they're a fan of celebrities. And on our Facebook page, we have a lot of people join in, everybody who joined in to say they hate celebrity culture, want nothing to do with it. Is there a common backlash you see?
Yeah, there is a love-hate relationship with celebrities and celebrity culture. And I think some of the hate comes from the fact that people do see celebrity culture as very trivializing and superficial because celebrity culture has colonized everything. You know, it's colonized our politics, our economy, our sense of values. And a lot of people really find that trivializing and awful, and especially with the boundaries between the news and entertainment being so blurred by, celebrity culture, to the point where, you know, we now have a former reality TV star as the president of the United States. And I think, then we see these admissions scandals with celebrities trying to, you know, buy their kids' way into college. And there is an enormous amount of resentment around that kind of arrogance and privilege, especially when right now we have the highest inequality, of wealth distribution in the United States.
Well, if anyone would like to own up to being a fan of a celebrity, we won't judge. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Susan, an interesting thing I'm seeing, I wonder what you think about it. It seems like there's a fragmentation of celebrity culture where, say, there might be a generation that has huge celebrities that they see on YouTube where their parents, I'm not speaking from experience here, where their parents have no clue who the people they're talking about are or why they're following them. There's a huge celebrity culture that might be invisible if you're not the right age or demographic.
That's absolutely right. You know, we live in such a fragmented media culture right now, filled with so many niche markets, not only on cable, but of course on social media. There are kids who just unpack toys on YouTube, and they earn so much money. You and I wouldn't know about these kids, but they become stars, and their parents are happy to have the kids be monetized while they open, the latest toy. PewDiePie, who is, one of the most followed YouTube stars and vloggers, I think most people didn't know about him until the New Zealand massacres, and he was named by, the shooter. So there are entire areas of YouTube of makeup influencers and Instagram influencers that many of us would have no idea who they are because the market is so fragmented and divided up right now.
Talking to Susan Douglas, co-author of the new book, Celebrity, A History of Fame. Well, you've mentioned reality TV some, and it seems like that was an interesting development in Celebrity where, kind of a normal person could suddenly be maybe not super famous, but kind of famous.
Yeah, and maybe famous for a little while. But here's what happened. As you know, there's just been such a powerful symbiotic relationship between the explosion of celebrity culture and the growth of different communications technologies. So you had the proliferation of all of these cable channels in the 90s and the early 21st century, and they needed content. And there were not enough A-list celebrities to go around to fill some of that content. And of course, in the early 2000s, A-list celebrities, unlike now, stuck to the movies. They didn't want to be on television. Things have changed. And so you had to manufacture celebrities, and reality TV was very cheap to produce. You could get people to go on for free or very little at first, and they would become stars. And so you had stars created via The Bachelor and The Real Housewives of wherever and, you know, The Real World. And so you could then promote these stars as well in the various fan magazines that really had their heyday in the first decade of the 20th century. They're struggling now because of, you know, online content. So this was really an industrial process to produce enough celebrities to have for all of these media outlets.
That's quite a visual image, the industrial production of celebrities. But do we still have enough celebrities or not enough celebrities to fill the media maw?
You know, the lifespan of some of these celebrities is short. So sometimes you have to keep reinventing new ones. And of course, you know, this is also happening in the music scene with, you know, with Spotify and so many new stars coming out. So, I mean, I think for many of us, it's like enough already with the celebrities. But from an industrial perspective, they constantly need to replenish the supply, especially if somebody's, you know, kind of capital wears off. I mean, Snooki was a big deal, you know, when was it, like 7 years ago? And now, like, who cares about Snooki? Same with Paris Hilton. So you have to be constantly replenishing the supply of celebrities given, you know, the industrial imperatives that are out there.
Seems like this book might have been tough to write because of the moving target, at least in the modern day. What are some of the frontiers you're watching for now when it comes to celebrity?
Well, you know, I think one thing that has affected a lot of people is this kind of fame famine. You know, people want this visibility because it converts into so many other things. And so we're seeing people trying to be Instagram influencers and YouTube vloggers. And there's a mythology that anybody can make a lot of money being an Instagram influencer or vlogger. And that's not true. It's a lot of work to be constantly online, constantly updating your presence. And so, you know, I'm an historian, so I'm really bad at predicting the future. But, you know, the question is going to be whether at some point some of this stuff is going to collapse. Because what is the most rare commodity these days? It's our attention. You know, we don't have enough attention for all of this stuff. And, you know, after a while, if there's not enough attention to go around, some of the star production, I think, may flag. We'll see.
Susan, briefly in our last few moments, has doing this work made you, you know, maybe look at that magazine in the grocery checkout line a little more closely?
Yeah, I mean, you know, yes. But, you know, I teach courses that include analyzing celebrity in the media, and my students, they aren't reading those magazines. It's all online now, and that makes it more interactive. Celebrities are trying to get around these kinds of magazines and really curate their own images on Instagram and try to create a very intimate relationship with followers just to keep their you know, identification and their fandom alive and well.
We'll leave it there for now. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Susan Douglas, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan and co-author of the new book, Celebrity, A History of Fame. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's big news in U.S. relations with North Korea and Iran. We'll get the latest and ask for your opinions. The author of the new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, tells us Native American history didn't stop in 1900. He shares the big issues facing Native Americans through the 20th century and into the modern day. And walleye is a Wisconsin fish fry favorite, but changing water conditions could mean that the fish is few and far between, with just a few lakes able to sustain a walleye population. A Wisconsin lake expert tells us why. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, join Kate and her guest for a look at the latest news in the standoff between the White House and the House of Representatives over a series of subpoenas. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk with the head of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. She says the state is bringing in a lot of tourist dollars, but we could still kick some more butt. Her words. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.